Terry Iddens talks on emptiness during a Skype talk in Sandpoint, Idaho, April 30th, 2014.
Friends and fellow explorers, hi, it's really great to see you all. Wow, a full gathering.
Okay.
And it looks very light out there. Is it a warm day?
Very warm. Very nice.
Great. So can you see and hear me okay?
Yes.
Great.
Are you recording?
I am, believe it or not. You know, it only took me about 3 years of trying before I got it, but we all have our own learning curves. So before I get started, one little piece of housekeeping. Linda and I have been talking about Wednesday nights, and as you all know, they've been well attended, but it's variable about the format of sharing. Sometimes sharing works really well and fruitfully and productively, and sometimes it doesn't seem to work so well. So we've been talking about alternatives, and we've come up with the idea of once a month trying something of a discussion group. Separate from sharing. It can be discussing a Dharma topic or a reading or anything of your choice. But it seems like a good idea to shake it up a little bit and experiment with something new. And it would be great if you all can participate and offer your participation and feedback about it. So that'll be one change we make. Before I get on with tonight's talk, I want to just remind us that it's always a good idea to start with recognizing how rare it is to embark on any Dharma activities, whether it's study or practice. The opportunity for that is very rare in human history. And cultivating a little gratitude is not only good for the soul, but it wears away a little bit of our self-clinging. So it's a good idea before any Dharma activity, sitting, studying, listening to talks, reading books. Similarly, following that with an aspiration, the aspiration of bodhicitta, to remind yourself that you're practicing not just for yourself, but for the eventual benefit to all beings. And even if you can't believe that's really true, the very act of doing it also wears down a little bit of self-centeredness and self-clinging. It makes it less of a self-improvement project. So that's why gratitude and aspiration are very valuable at the beginning of any Dharma activity. So as you know, tonight is, I'd like to record this on my iPhone too, if you don't mind. I'll just do that while we're at it.
Terry?
Yeah.
I just want to say, maybe I'll just raise my hand if there's not a good signal, and that instead of interrupting vocally,
okay.
And then we call each other back.
But don't be afraid to interrupt too. This is informal. And in fact, all of you, if it's breaking up or if I'm not talking loudly enough, is this a good volume?
Yes.
Okay. So as most of you know, this is the fifth in a line of talks about emptiness over the last 2 months. In last month, Frank talked about emptiness and compassion and how they are inseparable. And then 2 weeks ago, he talked about emptiness from the point of view of some of our contemporary wonderful Dharma teachers. And if you haven't had a chance to hear those, it's really worth going online to the website, where thanks to Kay and Gabrielle, we have wonderfully accessible recordings. And those two are really worth listening to. A month ago, I started a series of talks addressing the interplay of inquiry and emptiness. And varying a little bit, starting out leaning toward inquiry and showing how it relates to emptiness. And now we're moving more and more toward exploring the topic of emptiness itself. And that's where we are tonight. And tonight won't be the last, because really, this is the subject of the Dharma. But it's also the subject that terrifies most Dharma students. And I can certainly share in that aversion to studying emptiness. And tonight I'm going to see if we can diffuse that anxiety a bit and look at a user-friendly version of the approach to emptiness. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway, I'd like to start by talking about how we got here and why we're even bothering to address emptiness. And can you still hear me okay? Okay. You know, we all came for different reasons. It seems on the surface that we all came for really vastly different reasons. I'm getting a lot of feedback. Are you hearing that?
Yes.
Any ideas about how to reduce it?
I don't know, except maybe it's just in the connection and we can call you right back.
If it continues, we should do that. But right now it's gone away. So everything boils down to the first noble truth. Everything the Buddha taught can be summarized as the four noble truths. And as Frank told us last week, he really wasn't interested in answering questions that didn't directly address the first noble truth of suffering, that we all suffer. However, some of us come to the Dharma clearly suffering, catastrophe, crisis, terrible suffering that's evident. Some people come out of curiosity. Some people come where everything has gone well in their lives, and there's still this question, is this all there is to life? And all of these routes speak to another interpretation of the meaning of suffering. Many scholars think that the Buddha didn't really talk about suffering. He talked about the unsatisfactory nature of ordinary life. So it could be said that we all come from a certain level of dissatisfaction. If you were totally, thoroughly satisfied with how life was going, then you probably wouldn't have even come here out of curiosity. So our suffering, or better said, our dissatisfaction or the unsatisfactory nature of life is the first of three points that explain why we are talking about emptiness. It's a little bit hard sometimes to deal with the question of suffering. But even very well-off people who have all the money, all the possessions, all the good fortune, all the good health, and all the loving relationships that there are to be had still suffer. A friend of mine who's a psychologist and also a long-time Zen practitioner told me of a man who called her in tears from his big, beautiful yacht sailing off the coast of San Diego, where he was staying for a few weeks in his big, beautiful home with his new, beautiful wife. And he was in tears because none of it made any sense to him. And she told him to sell the yacht, sell the house, and come on home to Salt Lake City, where at the moment it was sleeting. And he did it, and he told her later that she saved his life. So it doesn't matter how it looks from the outside, everybody suffers. Why do we suffer? Well, we suffer due to mistaken perceptions and mistaken behavior. First, the mistaken perceptions. Jack Kornfield calls them unhealthy attachments. Frank talked with us about that 2 weeks ago. Has to do with identification of I, me, and mine, the sense of a solid, separate self. As Frank said, self equals suffering. But it's very hard to understand that because we all have this sense that we indeed are a separate, enduring I. I, me, mine. Robert Thurman, the father of Uma Thurman, the actress, is a longtime student of the Dalai Lama and a Buddhist scholar in a university back east. And he said that what this is really pointing to, this mistaken perception, is one that we all have and don't really confess very often. But it's the fixed belief that, indeed, I am the center of the universe. We all think that way on some level. And that's our mistaken perception. And because of this mistaken perception, we develop a mistaken strategy to life. As the Dalai Lama said, everybody wants to be happy. But because of our mistaken perception of a solid identification with this I, then we try to get happy by grasping at pleasure and pushing away pain, or grasping at gain and pushing away loss, or grasping at praise and pushing away criticism, or grasping at fame and pushing away rejection. And those eight steps having to do with gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and criticism, fame and infamy, are known as the eight worldly activities. Those are what we do in ordinary life because of our attempt to be happy, based on the sense of a self, a separate self. But the Buddha, who was for the most part a scientist, investigated this mistaken strategy and found that it guarantees our unhappiness. I'm not going to go into a lot of details of these three points tonight, but if you have questions about them, let's be sure to bring them up as questions. But again, it's that there is this unsatisfactory nature to ordinary existence, which is caused by the mistaken perception of a separate, solid identity as I, and then based on that, the mistaken strategy of attachment to what we think will make us happy and aversion to what we think will make us unhappy. And this mistaken strategy, it's not a sin, it's just a mistake. We naturally grasp at things to make us happy that either we don't get, so then we're unhappy, or we get it and then it rusts and goes away, and that makes us unhappy. Or we get, this even worse, we get something that we thought would make us happy, and it turns out it makes us very unhappy. And all of us have lived long enough to experience that. Same on the other side. We try to push away what we think will make us unhappy. Either we fail at pushing it away, or later we realize that we were wrong. So the mistaken strategy makes us unhappy and is why we suffer, why we find life unsatisfactory. So the Dharma, and in fact all the Buddha's teachings and many of the teachings of other world religions, have the goal of freedom, waking up from this dilemma, awakening to our true nature, and realizing wisdom and compassion. So realization, in the Buddhist sense, means realizing wisdom, which is the realization of emptiness. Wisdom is the realization of emptiness, the view of emptiness. And emptiness and wisdom are completely inseparable from compassion. Interestingly, wisdom is known as the feminine principle in many of the world's religions, including Buddhism. The Buddha of wisdom is named Prajnaparamita, and she's known as the mother of all the Buddhas, showing that in Buddhism, you can't be a Buddha unless you're born of the mother of the realization of emptiness, which is wisdom. The Buddha is quoted as saying, emptiness, actually he used the word sunatta. Sunatta is nibbana. Nibbana is sunatta. That's the Pali. In the Sanskrit, it's shunyata is nirvana. Nirvana is shunyata. So the usual English translation is emptiness is heaven, heaven is emptiness. We'll get back to that because it's a little puzzling. But it gives us an idea of why this is so important. Wisdom, realization, the mother of all the Buddhas, is the realization of emptiness. Okay, so the path. How do we get there? Well, in Buddhism, there is a path outlined by the Buddha. And over the last 2,500 years, people have created slight variations in that path that can actually look like huge contradictions. Here's a few. Sometimes it looks like we're being taught a developmental, gradual path. And other times it looks like we're being taught a sudden path, where in the developmental path we sit and we contemplate and we generate calm abiding and mindfulness, and over time we have insights, and these insights slowly develop and build on each other, and there's this dawning realization of the truth of things. On the other hand, there are Buddhist schools that are much more rapid. They're like schools of sudden realization, falling into grace. Interestingly, in ancient China, monasteries representing these two views of enlightenment actually went to war with each other, with swords and sabers and clubs, and did each other great damage, fighting over whether the true path was gradual or the true path was sudden. They were both wrong. But you know, we all have sudden insights into the nature of reality. But we don't usually recognize them. So the purpose of the teachings in Buddhism is to learn how to recognize them. It's like in birding or in botany or in entomology or in any subject, you don't see what you don't know. We have these experiences when the person finally breaks onto the summit of Everest, or when a person comes back from near death, or when you're crossing the street and you're almost killed by a car that stops an inch in front of you. And everything stops, and everything gets vast. And sometimes people describe a sense of a 360-degree view. And then we're back to our ordinary life and our ordinary perception. So the true nature of things isn't out there. And it's not that we're having to try to get something we don't have. What the Buddhist teachings are all about is learning how to recognize these moments and cultivate them so that these insights, these experiences happen consciously with recognition and then build on each other. So that's the gradual versus the sudden. The other two ways paths can look different are the path of renunciation or the path of welcoming everything. We've been pretty much, because of Frank's wonderful teaching on welcome everything, push away nothing, we've been on the path of welcoming everything. But it's a dangerous path. Some of you may have heard about the Bishop of Bling in Germany, who kept on welcoming everything until he had a $20 million mansion and five swimming pools. Renunciation is the opposite, where we deal with clinging by not having anything except for our begging bowl and our robe. And if we're really special, we get a staff. And an old saying in the path of renunciation is that one tea bag means one tea bag worth of problems. And you can see why. You have a tea bag, you start to worry about it being lost or being stolen or being torn, or maybe the paper in it is full of dioxins, and who knows what to worry about with a tea bag. So the in the case of the Bishop of Bling, the Pope had to give him mandatory renunciation, which isn't quite as fun an experience. But again, balance is necessary. And then there's the path of inquiry versus the path of devotion. And we tend to be on the path of inquiry here, where inquiry leads us to very important insights. But as you saw in that wonderful quote that Frank sent us several weeks ago from Ram Dass, who said that he sat in mindful meditation for some weeks and it was terribly, terribly dry, and he couldn't wait to have a hit of bhakti. That's love and devotion. So we're stuck in this apparent dichotomy. Inquiry is fruitful but dry. Faith and devotion are very juicy but very dangerous. We've seen the danger in teachers who are gone bad and seducing their students and running off with all the money, or in established religions that get power hungry and rigid and controlling. So we tend to be here on the developmental, gradual, welcoming, and inquiring path. But if you've practiced for a while, you realize that it's not really a dichotomy. You have sudden insights over time with the gradual path, and these build on each other. Those are openings that are a reflection of the rapid falling into grace path. We also have renunciation on our path. You renounce your desire to have the third beer because you know it'll interfere with your meditation that night. The joy of the loving aspect of the path can sometimes permeate even the strictest path of inquiry. So these dichotomies are in some way false. The path is all of these things, and we tend to experience them all over time. So let's get on to emptiness. We've talked about why we do it. Before I talk about emptiness at all tonight, I want to talk about some ground rules. The most common mistake in emptiness is to fall into the view that nothing matters. If everything is empty, nothing matters. So if you remember the dictum, first do no harm, which is what all physicians are sworn to do after graduation from medical school, first do no harm, then you'll be safe. People in the past have made the mistake that if everything is empty, then it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter if I hurt somebody else because they're empty, I'm empty, and the harmful act is empty, so what's the big deal? That's the path of nihilism, believing that everything is void. And it is a terrible, terrible misunderstanding of the truth of emptiness. So no matter how you understand or don't understand emptiness, if you just follow the dictum, first do no harm, you'll keep on the safe path. Because the view of emptiness denies nothing. Emptiness is not a void. The term non-self does not mean that the self does not exist. And when we say empty, empty does not mean that a thing does not exist. Those are just the ground rules. We're denying nothing, and you still have to be exquisitely careful with your activities. Do no harm. So, there are some approaches to emptiness that are non-threatening. And I'm going to walk us through three of these non-threatening approaches. The first has to do simply with synonyms for emptiness. Because actually, emptiness may have proven to be a bad choice for the English equivalent of shunyata. So most meditators who've been meditating for a long time report that their experience of emptiness is a sense of fullness. So right there we have a hint that emptiness doesn't mean what we normally think empty means. Most people who've been meditating a while experience it as a sense of fullness. And other synonyms for it are openness or spaciousness, or one that is increasingly in favor is boundlessness, boundless. Now, I don't know about you, but when I hear the word boundless, I tend to think of expansion. It's expanding out infinitely. And that's true. The Dalai Lama warns us, however, that we have to consider the fact that the entire universe of time and space can easily fit into a single atom. The entire universe of time and space fits easily within a single atom. Now, I hope that gives your mind a little jolt, because it's a hint of why we can't understand emptiness conceptually. Boundless means not only infinite going out, but it means infinite going in. It means that we have to also go down the rabbit hole, all the way down the rabbit hole, all the way in. And when you think about it logically, you see that logically this is true. If emptiness was only going outward and you couldn't go infinitely inward, then the boundless would be bounded. It would be bounded at the bottom of the rabbit hole. And that can't be the case. So boundlessness is a wonderful substitute word for emptiness. But you have to realize that boundlessness is really weird. I really love the root of shunyata, which is an Indo-European term called ku, K-E-U, which means to swell or to grow. Again, why would you use a root that means to swell or to grow as what we call emptiness? So it's not as it appears. And that brings us to the next user-friendly approach to emptiness, which is a way of antidoting our mistaken impressions. We think things are solid and real and independent. The Dalai Lama teaches that the best way around that is to continually hold in mind that things are not as they appear to be. Things are not as they appear to be. So if you only remember this, that the experience of emptiness is reported as fullness, that boundlessness may be a better word than emptiness, and that things are not as they appear. If you only remember those three things from tonight, then that will be a success. That's really all you need to know to get started on the path to wisdom. However, as is true on the Dharma path, there's more. And there is more. And this is a bit risky, and I thought a lot about it over the last couple of weeks, but I'm going to introduce a completely unexpected avenue to emptiness that in my own direct experience was the beginning of my experience of emptiness, and which is probably the most common approach to emptiness in the world in a way that's not even called emptiness. And what I'm talking about is the mystic experience, the experience of all the mystics of all the ages who saw everything as God, who saw God in everything, who saw that the only question you could really ask of somebody who was doubting this is to say, show me where God is not. This is the question of the mystics. Show me where God is not. You can't in this terminology. So I'm using the word God as a substitute for the word emptiness. And in most of Buddhism, the word that's used even more often than emptiness is awareness, as the ultimate truth. So in Buddhism, the ultimate truth, the ultimate essence, the ultimate reality, the way of abiding, the true nature of things is called timeless awareness. But timeless awareness and emptiness are a unity. So what we're talking about here is that emptiness as God means God as awareness. And actually, many of the Buddhist teachers from Asia who are coming over to the U.S. say, yeah, that's true. You can substitute God for awareness or God for essence or God for ultimate truth, as long as you're not talking about a limited creator God. So when I'm using the word God, I'm not talking about God the creator, because God the creator is dualistic. There's the creator here and the creation here. So puts God separate from creation, which is anything but boundless. In Buddhism, the way we would use the word God, timeless awareness, emptiness, is a unity. So getting back to the mystic view, the mystics had this unifying view of God, that God was in everything, everything was a manifestation of God. So let's take this pen. Can you see, can you see I'm holding up a pen? Okay, so in the mystic view, this pen is the manifestation of God. God is manifesting to us as this pen. The way this relates to emptiness is that then you would say, well, what is this? Is it a pen or is it God? And you would say the pen is empty of its own solid independent identity, because we also know in the mystic view that this is God manifest, God manifesting as a pen. And that's really close to the way Buddhism understands emptiness. That it's still a pen, it still works as a pen, just like the crescent wrench that I was talking about with Tom 2 weeks ago, or more than that. So emptiness isn't denying that this is a pen, but this pen is also more than emptiness. In the mystic view, this pen is a manifestation of the divine manifest, and it's also something I can write with. So the pen is empty of inherent, separate, solid penness. So this relates to unity, because if everything is God, then everything is interrelated and actually a unity. It relates to love, and that's the experience of it. The experience of it is not only fullness, but the experience, the mystic experience, is of love, what Ram Dass was referring to as bhakti. The bhakti of bhakti yoga on the surface is to this sublime teacher who is a realized being, but the teacher is only the symbol of the greater divinity, the wholeness of creation, of which perceiver and perceived are one. That's the mystic experience. The mystic calls it God. The realized Buddhist calls it timeless awareness, inseparable from emptiness, inseparable from compassion. And the experience of emptiness in this mystic way is the experience of the four immeasurables, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. The mystics call it God, the Buddhists call it timeless awareness. They're really talking about the same thing. And the core of that is emptiness. Okay. You don't have to believe this. You don't have to understand it because it's really beyond conceptual understanding. But there are many doorways to emptiness. This is the one we're starting with. Over ensuing weeks, I'll talk about many others having to do with the wave with the ocean, the bubble with the water, the echo, the mirage, the illusion. There are many, many ways of looking at emptiness. They all conform to what the Dalai Lama said. Things are not as they appear to be. So, one last thing. Where does inquiry come in? Well, in this sense, inquiry comes into our daily life. When we're off the cushion, if everything goes well on the cushion and you're meditating away and there's no big problem, then there's not a lot of call for inquiry for most people. This is just a broad statement. But throughout your day, I recommend an ongoing attitude of inquiry to open the gates of wisdom. The first is something that a senior student taught me years ago, and that was, don't believe any of your thoughts. Don't deny them. Just doubt their absolute validity. Don't believe any of your thoughts. Or another way of putting that is don't trust any of your thoughts. So when you have a judgment, a belief, a story, an opinion, a mood, and it always seems very real and very defensible and very absolute, just don't trust it. Don't deny it. Don't push it away. Just don't trust it. Simply that. Another kind of inquiry is to always ask of everything, especially your thoughts and beliefs and emotions and stories, is this true? And then ask, what else is true? So even if you're absolutely convinced that your judgment of somebody is fully warranted and your opinion of that person is absolutely true, ask, what else is true? Is this really what's happening, or is there a larger picture? And then following Adyashanti's lead, another good question is, more in a time where you can have room to contemplate, what do I know that is absolutely true? This is the question Adyashanti would use when he was sitting at Starbucks writing, and he wouldn't write anything until he knew it was absolutely true. And then the final question of all, what am I? So don't believe any of your thoughts. Of everything, ask, is this true? If you think it's true, ask what else is true. What do I know that's absolutely true? And what am I? So I think that's enough talking. Gina, would you mind handing out those handouts? So this handout is just an attempt to expand on that one point of looking at emptiness as the everything being a reflection of the divinity, a manifestation of the divinity. And the first one is from Mechthild of Magdeburg, who's one of my very favorite of the Christian mystics. Interestingly, she was born the same year as Rumi, and they never got to meet. Mechthilde wrote about, you can read this. Of all that God has shown me, I can speak but the smallest word. No more than a honeybee takes on her foot from an overspilling jar. She's describing the experience that the Buddhists all have when trying to describe emptiness. there is no conceptual way of understanding emptiness, and so words are really a problem. The defining sutra of the Mahayana Buddhism is the Heart Sutra, which begins with a little preamble that goes, indescribable, inconceivable, inexpressible. The perfection of sublime knowing is unborn and unceasing, the very nature of space. Remember the spaciousness. It is the realm of your own self-knowing, timeless awareness, which is synonymous with emptiness. I pay homage to the mother of the Buddhas of the three times. That's emptiness. So the Heart Sutra is all about emptiness, and it begins by reminding us that it's indescribable, inconceivable, and inexpressible. And if you think you understand it, then you'll see that you're wrong when you actually consciously experience it. So all of these teachings on emptiness are just fingers pointing in different directions. And I chose this teaching about everything as God for two reasons. One is, even before the Buddha was born, people were experiencing emptiness this way. The actual mystic experience of God is of unity, totally non-dual. So everything is both God and as it appears. Both are true. So the thing is empty of solid identity, including us. So, Rumi, your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it. What you seek is seeking you. This is talking about what I already mentioned, that love and emptiness can actually be seen as synonymous, emptiness synonymous with love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Love is emptiness as the truth of things, as wisdom. And it's seeking you means basically it is not outside you. The core part of your being is seeking to wake up. What are you waking up to? You're waking up to your own true nature. What is your own true nature? It is wisdom. It is unity. It is the four immeasurables. It is emptiness, compassion. So what you seek is seeking you, is an absolute truth. Rumi knew it. So MacTill knew that you couldn't describe it, and Rumi knew that it's already the core of you. You just don't recognize it. The next quote is by Swami Ram Dass, and he's describing the enlightened experience from the point of view of a mystic. For you, the world outside will now stand transformed as the very expression or manifestation of God. Everywhere the light of God will dazzle your eyes, even in the apparent diversity and activity of nature. You will strangely be conscious of an all-pervading stillness and peace of the eternal, a consciousness which is unshakably permanent. You will also feel that you are liberated from the harassing dualities of the, I should put on my glasses for this. harassing dualities of life, followed by the crowning experience of an abiding state of ineffable ecstasy. This is the description of the enlightened experience. Before we're fully enlightened, he's a little bit wrong about the unshakable permanence of it, in that people get glimpses of it and then lose them, as Adyashanti has so beautifully described in his writings. But it is true that the third noble truth promises us just this, that when you finally are fully awake, it is permanent. You can't get rid of it. So this third paragraph here is a beautiful description of the mystic experience. And then the last quote, I'll let you read on your own, but the part at the end, which I have italicized, the author didn't do that. All contemplative acts, silences, poems honor the world this way. Brought together by the eye of love, a milkweed pod, a twig, allowing us to see how things had been all along, a feast of being. Beautiful contemporary view of that. And the artists are always giving us views of this essence. I cleverly haven't left a lot of time for questions. But I'm good for any that you might have. You know, we've talked about several things that you could have questions about. The fact that everybody suffers, and that is caused by mistaken perceptions and mistaken behaviors, the core of the problem. So you might have questions about that. Or what path are we on among these six views of the path? Or what is the view of nihilism? You know, just anything is fair.